be harder, at least morally harder than most. I don't know, it didn't seem so bad to me, but maybe on second thought, wasn't such a great idea. It brings you to having to perform at least one way to do it, the way that I had in mind. It brings you to perform an oscillatory integral, which you have to take as a, in some sense as a limit, and then it's a not such necessarily such an easy integral. In fact, I even said in class the problem with those problem one and problem two was find what omega sub n is and associate it with the surface area of the unit sphere. So people suffered long and hard over that, and I didn't mean to make that the character of the homework, at least not at this point in the course. So thanks for your work. Wasn't a brilliant problem set problem. I mean, I was redoing it in the bus for you all, but wasn't such a brilliant problem set problem, I guess. I'd like to completely change tack today, meaning I don't want to talk about PDE, because we have a backlog. In some sense, I wanted to get going on studying differential, I wanted to have differential equations on the blackboard from the very beginning, but that meant that we deferred a little bit of analysis. So I'd like to go back. Since our theme, for the most part, has been the Fourier transform, it's the analysis of the Fourier transform which we've deferred. So I'd like to go back and talk basically about the Fourier transform. So that's section 2.4, properties of the Fourier transform. Actually, I just want to make sure that everyone spells this right. F-O-U-R-I-E-R. From the homeworks, you could see it's not necessarily completely yet self-evident. Okay. So the Fourier transform plays an enormous role in analysis. I mean, it's hard to underestimate that. And consequently, it shows up in all forms and all sorts of settings. So what I have to do is I can't talk about them all. I'm going to talk about, and I can't even talk about all the ones that are relevant for PDE or even elementary aspects, but I'm going to talk about two. So those settings are going to, well, there are a variety of situations, but settings for me today is going to mean on what class of functions do I work? That is, on what function space do I work? So the two cases, you might say the most natural cases, are Hilbert space, so L2 of Rn, Hilbert space, and Schwarz class. And now probably almost everyone has seen these, but just bide with me. I'm going to define them and talk about them, and that's the theme, that's the material of today's 2 or 2.5 hours of lecture. Just to see about that, can I take a survey? Who's seen L2 before? Everybody, most people. Who's seen Schwarz class of functions before? A few less people. Okay, so we're still all right. Good. And this is an example of a Hilbert space, and I'll talk about a little bit about Sobolev spaces as well. So let's start with a definition. Sorry? This is Schwarz. There'll be another S for Sobolev. Okay? This is Schwarz class. I will tell you what Schwarz class is if you don't know. But you have to wait. Okay? First things first. This is my first statement of definition today, which is what the usual Hilbert space for us. So the I don't know what I want to call it. Maybe the canonical Hilbert space. And I'm even going to define what a Hilbert space is today, so don't worry. I mean, the only thing to worry about is boredom. The canonical Hilbert space for us is going to be L2, and we work in n dimensions. So that consists of, so let's call that, I don't know, let's call it H, or Hilbert. So it's a set of functions, f of x, measurable, well, just don't even have a right that, but the measurable functions, real or maybe complex valued. So they take Rm, maybe complex valued, such that if I do the following thing, I take f of x, a norm, square it, it's also a measurable function, I take its integral, dx, that's finite. Nothing unusual about that. Okay? And, but now I want to, and probably many people have seen that before. What I want to do is just make a list of properties this class of functions has. So properties. So this is a proposition 2. Properties. Maybe even I should have said elementary properties. Because the more advanced properties we'll talk about at a later point. Right. Which is, well, and these are elementary. So L2 of Rn is a linear space. I told you I was going to define what a Hilbert space is. That is, suppose F and G are an L2, and alpha and beta, say, complex numbers, then alpha F plus beta G is also an L2. Then, so you can add things in it. It has a norm. So the norm, that means the distance of a point in L2 from 0 is equal to, well, it's up to us to define, and it's the familiar thing. Square root. And what does the norm have to do? What does the norm need to do? So this is a definition of our norm, but an abstract norm needs to do the following thing. So it satisfies. let's see. How about the following thing? I want it non-negative. And non-degenerate, that is. Let me write it this way. So if f equals 0, then the only point in the space is 0, which does that. And I also want it homogeneous. That is, the norm of alpha f is equal to modulus of alpha norm of f for any of these alphas in L2. Am I forgetting axioms? You have to check me. Sorry? We're getting to that. I haven't got that axiom yet. Right? I further want, it has a norm, and it's not a traditional place to put it, but I want the space to be complete with respect to that norm. Well, you're right. Maybe Dimitri tells me to put in the triangle inequality. So I'll put in the triangle inequality, which is, in terms of L2, also called the Minkowski inequality, which says, if I take the distance from 0 of f plus g, it's less than or equal to the distance from 0 from f plus distance 0 from 0 to g. And, of course, everyone knows that this is this picture. Here's f. Here's a Hilbert space. Here's f. Here's g. Let me make f a little bit more. Let me make g a little bit longer to make this more fun. Here's g. Here's f. Not a very good rectangle. Parallelogram. That's a better one. Here's f plus g. Sorry about my artistry. There's f plus g. Still still not a very good. Sorry about that. You know what? F is the problem. I'm allowed to do this, aren't I? There, that's a better F. Now it looks a little bit more like a parallelogram. There's F plus G, which is shorter than the sum of F, length of F plus some length of G. And complete. So L2 is complete with respect to this norm. Yes?
Like L2 are two steps from the spread, right?
Yeah.
Can you give an example where, you know, it's just we take L1, which is not L2?
Yeah.
Of
a function which is L1 and not L2.
Yeah.
Okay, I will be distracted from my lecture and give a function. Who has a function which is L1 but not L2? I'm going to even add to that question. It's always nice. It's always nice to be distracted from the lecture. So let's do the following thing. I'm going to take R1, and not only that, I'm going to look only at functions with support in 0, 1. So support of F is going to lie in 0, 1. Okay? So why don't I do the following? How about F of x is equal to x to the, I need a letter, x to the k. And if k is positive, it's bounded on 0, 1. Oh, x to the k times the characteristic function of 0, 1. So if that k is positive, it's bounded, so it's in all LP spaces. This is more advanced than what I'm defining here. But x is negative, what space is it in? So if k is negative, what space is it in? So integral of, let's make it x to the, integral of x to the k dx between 0 and 1. And that, and then you have to take it, sorry, and you take the absolute value of this, which is immaterial, and then take it to a pth power. And what do we need about p? For fixed k, what do we need about p? P, k has to be bigger than minus 1, or else it's infinity. So you can imagine k's. Pick your favorite p. You can adjust the k. So that's your question. Now here's my question. Should I make it a problem set problem? I don't know. Take the intersection of all the LP spaces. Is this equal to L infinity? Intersection p. 1 less than or equal to p less than infinity. That's my question. So now I'm going to go back to the lecture, which are these notes, but think about it and give me the answer in a couple of minutes. Okay? It's along those lines. I'm glad you asked that. Certainly amuses me to keeps us on a little bit on our toes. I want to tell you what completeness is, because it's reasonable to, when I'm defining everything from the very beginning, I should say it right. So what does it mean to be complete? That is, if I have a sequence of functions fn in L2, Rn, and this is a sequence labeled, say, by fk, let's label it by k equals 1 to infinity, and it's Cauchy. So if this is a Cauchy sequence, then there exists a limit function f, also in L2, such that fk converge to f. And now there are a zillion type of convergence, but we're talking about L2, so it's L2 converge to f. And that means that fk minus f in L2 norm goes to 0 as k goes to infinity. Now what does it mean to be a Cauchy sequence, you might ask? Who needs for me to say what a Cauchy sequence is? Please don't be timid, because I'm ready to say Thank you. A Cauchy sequence. This is Cauchy when, for all epsilon, there exists a cutoff n. Maybe I'll make a cutoff capital K because the index is little k, such that for all little k and little l greater than cutoff n, the difference between f little k and f little l in L2 is less than epsilon. That means these things might be far apart, but ultimately they have to be close together. It doesn't say there's a limit one. It just says that all these things are bunching up. But completeness says if they bunch up, they have to converge to something. Okay? Anyone willing yet? It's open to students or non-students can answer. The logarithm. That's a way of saying no. No. And the answer is the logarithm. So thanks. Thanks. So, okay. The answer is no. Think about it some more. But I need the blackboard. Well, I'll tell you what. I'll start on the bottom. What have I forgotten about Hilbert space? Well, the norm in a Hilbert space is given by an inner product. So that's property 1, property 2, property 3, in fact. So let me, property 3, in fact, is the norm on L2 is given by an inner product, which is to say, so that means I'm going to define an inner product between f and g to be the integral over Rn of f of x, g of x, bar, because f and g can be complex valued, dx. You can probably already tell that I learned this in a math class because a physicist would do the following thing, f bar g. I mean, I don't know how to resolve this conflict other than let's decide to put the bar somewhere and then not move it around too much. It's because to say A star A is easier, rhymes better than to say A star, and here's A star. You see, A star A, better to have a star in the middle. I can't help it, this is what mathematicians do. All right? And then given this inner product, the L2 norm, well, square of it, is FF, which is nice. And let's see, we have a Minkowski inequality, but also this inner product satisfies the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. Which is that if I take the inner product of two functions, f and g, both in L2, well, not even in L2, it's less than or equal to f and L2, g norm in L2. Why do I say not even in L2? Because if something's not in L2, the right-hand side's infinity, so I can put anything on the left-hand side. Okay. And the last comment is number 4, which is, what's the dual space? So given a Hilbert space, given a topological linear space, how about given a Banach space, I want to say. I haven't said that word yet. Given a Hilbert space, there, you can look at the space of bounded linear functions. So given H, you can consider the space of bounded linear functionals. On H, and H being Hilbert, and this, so such a thing, let's call it H prime, and being a Hilbert space, L2 of Rn, its dual space is itself. That's the property of a Hilbert space. Good. That's what I wanted to say. Now, if I find some other linear class, find some other class of functions which is a linear space, which has a norm, and the norm, what's the stuff that defines a norm, that is, something which is non-degenerate, you can distinguish zero as homogeneous degree one, and it satisfies triangle inequality, so that is property one and two, if I got it right. One plus two implies that our space is a Banach space. Right? I don't see anything more. I need a complete normed. That's part of two. Complete. That's part of two. And if the norm is given by an inner product, let's say one and two and three, did I get that right? Three, a norm given by inner product, that's called the Hilbert space. And so we've had a course in functional analysis in the last 15 minutes. That's what I want to do with it. Sorry? The dual space is the space of bounded linear functionals on, the dual space of H is the space of bounded linear functionals on H. Do you want me to define that? Dual is a word which is defined by this statement. Now, this statement has words in it too, but I would prefer not to get bogged down I'm happy to explain it, but maybe we should vote whether we should be doing lots of functional analysis or minimal functional analysis. How about let's talk afterwards? This is how you define dual spaces, definition of dual. Okay? So that's good. That's what I wanted to say. And let's see, why talk about this particular Hilbert space? It's because it's very natural for the Fourier transform. So that's my statement. Natural, L2, not Hilbert space in abstract, but really L2 in specific is natural. It's a natural setting for the Fourier transform. Okay, so let's just remember, and we have to get our constants right. What am I doing? I take f of x, dx e to the minus I c dot x. And x is in Rn, and c is also in another copy of Rn. And then I integrate this, and I normalize it by a root 2 pi. And that's what we've been doing all along, and that's f hat of c. I want to give it another name, too, because sometimes it's nice to think of this as an operator. It operates on function and gives us another function, possibly in another space. So let's call it f, a lot of f's, f of c. You take f and you Fourier transform. Sorry, I should have called the function g. And that makes a little more sense, but a lot of f's. But you take f of f, and then you get f hat. Okay. Theorem. So this is our third statement of the day. The Fourier transform is an isometry of L2 of Rn. That is, so I have to explain what I mean. That is, when you start with F in L2 of Rn, then you take its Fourier transform, that's called F hat, and it turns out to also be an L2 of Rn. Of course, the variable here you call c, and the variable here you call x, but it doesn't matter. Still a function L2 of Rn. And moreover, if I look at the distance of f to the origin, it's the same as the distance of f hat to the origin. That's all I need to have to be an isometry. On the other hand, people want this as a problem set problem? I found it such an elementary thing, which is nice to know the answer, that maybe yes. Okay, so problem set problem. So I want to do this as a problem set problem, but let's also do this as a problem set problem. Especially because the last problem set three was so hard, let's do some easy ones. Okay? So, So I'll make this problem set, are we number six now or number five? Did I give any problems last time? I did. So this is problem set number six. Amazing. So one is, seems to me Andre has said that this is no, so how should I phrase it? Is the intersection of the LP spaces equal to the L infinity? I'll phrase it as a question. Domain, bounded domain and unbounded domain? Yeah. Yeah, all right. It's easier on the unbounded domain, but all right. No, it's about the same. So 1A, let, this is a domain. I want that to be the unbounded Rn. Is the intersection over all P greater than 1 and less than infinity of LP of omega equal to L infinity of omega? Why or why not? And Andre already seems to have given us the answer, but you know, he might not be right. You never know. Why or why not? And then part B is let omega, well, equal be bounded. A bounded domain. Bounded. Same question. Two, that's the question I wanted to ask, is show, all I said was you take the Fourier transform and have the same distance from zero. Okay, what I want you to show, I want you to show that, let's say it geometrically. Show that the Fourier transform, that is operator F, preserves angles between vectors. Between elements of L2. Between F, G, N, L2 of Rn. That is to say, if I look at the inner product of F, G, let me look at its real part. That's equal to F, L2, G, L2. And it's less than or equal to this number, and the amount that it is off, I'm going to call cosine theta. And then the same is, you look at the real part of F hat G hat, and it's going to be F hat L2, G hat L2. Of course, these are in the C spaces, these are in the X spaces. And this is going to be cosine of some capital theta, capital theta. And of course, my saying, we haven't proved it, but my saying that the lengths are preserved says that this is equal to that and this is equal to that. But how about this equal that? So I want you to show that. So show little theta is equal to capital theta. And that's why it's an isometry. Well, that's one nice way to say it's an isometry. However, I don't want to prove theorem 3 for you yet. It's more fun if I carry on. So proof of theorem 3 deferred for a bit. Okay? And I wanted to do it after I discussed Schwartz class. But let's see, before we go on, let me just say other examples of Banach spaces. So other examples of function spaces relevant for analysis or analysis of PDE. Well, No, that's 1 less than or equal to p, strictly less than plus infinity. That's a plus, but if you don't like it, I'll take it away. Other examples of function spaces. Well, I already mentioned LP, so we better put it up. LP of a set omega is equal to the set of measurable functions on F. They could be complex valued, why not? Such that I do the following thing. I take the absolute value of F to the pth power, that's also measurable. I integrate it over the set dx. I guess I'm always with respect to the Lagrange measure. We can even put a measure here, and that's finite. That's one example. Another example of, and these are Banach spaces. For 1 less than or equal to p less than infinity, and p equals 2 is Hilbert, our Hilbert space that we were worrying about. And you can also make a Banach space about p equals infinity. In fact, we've been doing it all this time. And in fact, that's an interesting thing to say, which is contrasts with our problem 1, which is you might want to show that if you take f and you take its LP norm, and you take the limit as p goes to infinity of this, and you might say that this is going to be its L infinity norm. And now I have to worry. I think I need the domain to be bounded for this to occur, although I'm actually not completely sure. I think it needs to be bounded. So I need when omega is in Rn, bounded. So this is a standard theorem in first course in functional analysis. You might contrast that with that statement. Interesting. Okay. Another example, or class of examples, are Sobolev spaces. I'll call them H super S. I want to build them on Rm. Those are those class of functions f of x, such that I take f of x and I square it, that's still measurable, but I also take lots of derivatives. So d by dx alpha. And then I want to integrate this dx, then I want to sum over all 0 less than or equal to alpha less than or equal to s. So s, I guess, want to be integer. S here. S is going to be an integer, a natural number. Could be 0, then we have our old L2. And then I want all of these to be less than plus infinity. And that's one classical Sobolev space, which is a Hilbert space. So it's A Hilbert space. And then there's other class. This can go on forever. The other classes, so there's the further Sobolev spaces. I'll just call them WSPRN, which you make out of this plus this. You take all those S and you do the same thing. Sum 0 less than alpha less than or equal to S, partial X to the alpha F of X. But you don't take 2, you take the pth power. And then if you want the norm, you take the pth root, and I'll do the norm here also, the second root, the square root, pth root, and you want all those to be less than plus infinity. And that's the WSP spaces. So now I get to give my warning, which is contrary to many courses and textbooks on the subject, the study of PDE is not the study of functional analysis. And the study of PDE is not the study of, at least in my opinion, the study of lots of varieties of Banach and Hilbert spaces and how they all fit together. Those are tools that you use when convenient and or necessary. So if you're going to be adept or work in the subject or even know something about the subject, typically you know a lot about spaces. However, those are your tools. And I think the two should be kept healthily separate in order to maintain good taste. Of course, that could be a controversial statement. Some of my colleagues This is a story, this is a PDE course, and all they talk about is spaces the entire year. Barely do they differentiate. So I'd like to err on the other side. Okay, I'm going to move on and talk about Schwartz class. So this is definition 4. But this is Schwartz. Named after Laurent Schwartz, who died in the past year, I guess. Past 18 months ago. So, let's see. So I want another class of functions. Oh, and we're going to talk about the Fourier transform on L2, and we're also going to talk about the Fourier transform on Schwartz class, and those are the two very natural settings for the Fourier transform, okay? Theorem 3 is already one reason why it's natural in L2. So what I want for Schwartz class is of functions, so a class of functions, f of x defined on Rn, such that for all alpha, beta, which are indices, I take x to the power alpha, partial x to the power beta, f of x. I take its absolute value, and then I take the supremum over all x and Rn, and I get a finite number. So each choice of alpha and beta, that is bounded by. So it says that it's bounded by a that. So that number, that for a given function, that says that this is equal to a constant alpha beta, which is a finite constant. But the constant that definitely, in almost all cases, the constant's going to depend on alpha and beta. It probably will get bigger as alpha and beta get bigger. Okay? And it's a linear, this turns out to be a linear space. So in particular, it turns out to be a space where you have to have all your derivatives. Because if a derivative doesn't exist, this is going to blow up at some finite alpha and beta. If the 13th derivative at some point x doesn't exist is infinite, then this is infinite for one particular alpha at that point which you're looking at. And so such functions are smooth. So this is a linear space. It's a linear space of functions. And, I mean, that's what Schwartz class is. Linear space with a topology not a Banach space. Not a Banach space. The topology is a little bit more uncomfortable. The linear space is really quite pleasant. So I have to say something about notation because I've already used it here and I felt uncomfortable and now I'm using it even more here, so I have to talk about notation for a minute.
Just a quick question.
Yeah?
Alpha and beta, I mean, beta is obviously an integer. Alpha, what are the restrictions on alpha in the definition?
Let me tell you what the notation is. I sort of put it down and it's my style. I put this down and then if I gave you the notation first, then you have no reason why to ask about alpha and beta. So I'm glad you're asking about alpha and beta because I'm saying, thank you that you asked. Here's what I mean by alpha and beta. So alpha and beta are multi-indices. And when you do lots of calculations with multiple variables, it helps to manipulate these gracefully, or else you just get bottled up in counting in complex notation. So let me say how we use them. So alpha is the following thing. I need an n vector of with integer entries, non-negative integer entries. Alpha 1, alpha 2, up to alpha n, where each and then beta of course is the same. Beta 1, beta 2, beta n, where each alpha j in those entries and each beta j in those entries are natural numbers. And natural numbers include zero for me. I guess I'm post-Roman in that. Right? We need a zero. And now, so that says the following thing. And if I look at x to the alpha is equal to x1 to the alpha 1 t- times x2 to the alpha 2 times, so it's a monomial with all these monomial entries, xn to the alpha n. And partial x to the beta, I've already used it a bunch of times and just slipped it by you, but here we might as well be precise. Oh, I can write x's in the following way. Product j equals 1 to n, xj to the alpha j. And partial x beta is, of course, partial x1 to the beta 1, dot, 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 to partial xn to the beta n. Now it makes perfect sense. Okay? And, of course, this is a monomial of degree. Well, which degree? So let's agree. So let's say that it's convenient to say that the length of alpha is equal to alpha 1 plus alpha 2 plus alpha n. And so this is now a monomial, because it has all these powers of x, of degree, the length of the multi-index alpha. And since beta has the same thing, then this is a differential operator of order the degree beta. So this is order of differentiation of the length of beta. Very convenient, right? And it's convenient for other things. For example, so example of use of multi-indices. Well, I've already given you one. I take arbitrary powers of x, and all the xj's and the different directions have powers, and the arbitrary differential operators, and those are all possible ones, finite order differentiation, and that's what I do to f. Let me give you another example. If I want to take the Taylor series, well, watch this. It says f of x, so near a point y, so Taylor series at y, you do the following thing. F of x, it has a Taylor expansion. I'll just write it is going to be described asymptotically by its Taylor expansion. Sum over alpha of 1 upon alpha factorial partial x to the alpha f times x minus y to the alpha power. Oh, f at y times x minus y to the alpha power. Nothing to remember about it. Looks like one-dimensional Taylor series. You just have to remember that this is vectorial notation. This is vectorial notation. Look down there. That's what it means. And what is 1 over what is alpha factorial? Yes. Yep. Yep. Or detach the board and bring it over. So, what is alpha factorial? Is equal to alpha 1 factorial times alpha 2 factorial times alpha n factorial. If you just do that, Taylor series is easy. Very convenient, nothing deep about it, except it's an extremely nice invention due to Laurent Schwartz, among other things. Very useful, helps us do stuff, despite the fact that in some sense it's just notation. Okay, let's do some examples. Because we had some examples of what's in, what's not in L2, LP, etc., let's do some examples here. Sorry? I'm going to give you the topology. It is not a topology given by a norm. No, it doesn't have it. It has a topology, but it won't be given by a norm. It's Fréchet. We'll get to that. But first, let's go through our little examples, because that's fun, too. Okay, so let's have a little bit of audience participation. F of x is equal to e to the minus x squared upon 2. Is this in L2? Is it in Schwartz class? Okay. Example 2. F of x. Oh, I had a question for you. This is examples and questions. So this one is a question. C 0 infinity. That's infinitely smooth functions, infinitely differentiable functions with compact support. Is that in Schwartz class? Yep. Schwarz class is also in the set of infinitely smooth functions where you don't say anything about how it decays at infinity. If all derivatives, so that's right, what should I say is here? This is a statement that all derivatives decay faster than any polynomial in order to make this finite. So all derivatives decay faster than any polynomial, such as an exponential, which has all derivatives behaving like an exponential, is such a thing.
So
yeah?
The alpha and beta, they don't need to be of the same degree in
order. Not at all. Not at all. First you test all derivatives, then you test all powers of x, and then you test the middle ones. You might do some interpolation. I mean, who knows, but best to do them all. Best to do them all. Okay, this is true, right? So here's a question. Or didn't have that question yet. Didn't have that question yet. I'll put it up now. Question. Let's see how I wanted to say it. The real analytic functions, that's in C infinity, right? So my question is C infinity inside the real analytic functions? So here's my question. Let me go back to examples. I got a little ahead of myself. That's a couple pages in my notes, but example number 3. How about if I have f to x is equal to 1 plus x squared to the power minus, say, b? Is that in Schwarz class? You can take its derivatives arbitrarily often. Make b integer. You can take its derivatives arbitrarily often, yes? So it's certainly C infinity. Is it in Schwarz class? Why? Doesn't decay fast enough. It only decays at power 2b, right? It looks like x to the minus 2b, but then I'll take x here to be 2b plus 1, and this will be infinite. So not in Schwarz. Is it in L2? Depends upon b. If b is greater than n upon 4, why 4? Because here's a 2, and then you square it, you get rid of the next 2. If b is big enough, this decays fast enough to be integrable, to be square integrable over R. It's in L2. Good. Last example. F of x is equal to e to the minus x. Is that in Schwarz class? Is it in L2? Is it in L2? People say yes, but timidly, it's in L2. It's in L2. Is it in Schwarz class? This wasn't in Schwarz class. It's perfectly smooth, but it didn't decay fast enough. Is this in Schwarz class? Decays plenty well. Is it in Schwarz class? No. Why not? That corner at the origin is not so nice. You can't differentiate it, not even once. So it's not in Schwarz class. Not in Schwarz class. Very good. I'm glad to see we're amusing ourselves. This is a monomial, a lot of powers of x, of degree modulus alpha. What's the modulus of alpha? Up there, sum the powers of the individual polynomials. This is a differential operator. Of what order? Order modulus beta, where beta is defined by the same way. Tells us why we take the length of a multi-index the way we do. Topology of S. Topology. Of S. Well, you can certainly say that the distance of S from the origin, given a particular alpha and beta, you could say it works perfectly well to say the sup over X in Rn of the size of X to the alpha partial x to the beta of f of x. So that actually is almost a norm, if you just take that. It's called the seminorm. It's the alpha beta seminorm. And the only problem with S is that I need to control all of them, which is an infinitely many objects. So let's say the topology of S says that the topology says a sequence S n equals one, Fk, k equals 1 to infinity, converges, but now converges in Schwarz class to F, to some F, when, so I should say, if all seminorms Fn minus F, I'm going to measure it in the alpha beta seminorm, so that's the sup over x, right, of x to the alpha d by dx to the beta of the difference, Fn minus F, evaluated at x and then take the sup over x, goes to zero as our k, this is supposed to be indexed by k, because n is the dimension, as k goes to infinity. However, I don't want to enforce a uniform rate over all possible alpha and beta. So not necessarily a uniform rate of convergence, uniform over all choices of alpha and beta, and there are infinitely many choices. Okay, so no uniformity assigned. So it's a linear space. Clearly, seems to me, if you have two functions with decay, you can take some linear combination that still will decay, and its derivatives will too. But you can't, with a Banach space topology, nicely control this class. But you can define a metric. So the topology is given not by a norm, by a metric. Topology. So this sense of convergence can be dictated by a metric. So what's the following way? Oh, let's see. I want to say the distance from F to G is equal to. Well, it should have something to do with F minus G in the alpha beta seminorm. But I don't want this to be. Let's see. But I don't want to demand any uniformity. So what I'll do is I'm going to say, I could also do the following thing. I'm going to make this quantity saturate for large distance between F and G. So I could do 1 plus F minus G in the same seminorm. Now it's no longer homogeneous, so it's not going to look like a norm, but it still is positive and zero only if alpha minus G, F minus G is zero in the alpha beta seminorm. And then I'm going to sum over all possible alpha beta. So this is bounded by the smallest this could be is 0, and the biggest this could be is 1, I guess. But now I don't want to enforce any uniformity, so I'm going to sum over 1 to the 2 to the alpha plus beta, and just for good measure, plus 1. So the maximum distance between any two functions is 1 in the entire space. Nonetheless, if F goes to G in Schwarz class, that forces convergence in every seminorm, although it does not demand any uniformity. That's the distance. So that's the metric. Okay? Such things are called Fréchet spaces. And the norm is a little more complicated to deal with, so it's not so pleasant necessarily, but it definitely is a prime example of a Fréchet space. Other examples are C0 infinity, where you have the sequence of seminorms just F beta is equal to sup over X. C infinity. Both. Let me do C naught infinity. So you have soup over X in a compact set K of, so let's see, the semi-norm now has to depend on K, soup over X in a compact set K of dx beta of f of x, right? And the funny thing is, I guess that also works for the C-infinity semi-norms. And then to make this sum, you don't sum over all compact sets. That's not such a handsome thing, but you exhaust your space by compact sets somehow. Okay? I think that's right. We got the C-infinity and C0-infinity semi-norms right? Any experts in the audience want to comment on that? I think that's right. Okay. Back to this question. Is C0 is in Schwarz, is in C0 infinity is in Schwarz class, is in C infinity. Real analytic functions are in C infinity, aren't they? Are real analytic functions in, are there some real analytic functions in Schwarz class? Oh, that's a question. Any real analytic functions in Schwarz class? Yeah. Are all C infinity functions real analytic, for example? Sorry? Well, I haven't said what real analytic is. So real analytic is the restriction to the real axis of functions which could be extended to be analytic in a possibly small neighborhood of the axis. And so they don't have to satisfy Cauchy-Schwarz because that depends on the y of the extension. The answer is no. I'm getting in deeper than I want. So this is no. And I guess I'll tell you why. Maybe I'll talk further about this when we talk about the Kosher-Kowalewski theorem, which is in the future. Let's have a break. It's 11:31 on my watch. So it seems an appropriate time for a break because I'm going to come back and start talking about, where's the Fourier transform? I'm going to come back and start talking about the Fourier transform. okay, we haven't done any work yet today, so we eventually have to do something. So let's start with that. I'll start with lemma 5. It's going to be something we should actually have to prove, and it's a technical lemma. So I want to do the following. Let's see. It has two parts. One I'm going to prove, one you're going to prove. It's always pleasant. So part one is, let's take G in Schwartz class with G of 0 equal to 1. And the statement is, then, for all F in Schwartz class, the limit as epsilon goes to 0, and this is a limit in the sense of a Schwartz class
limit, right?
It's the limit in, how do I say it, in Schwartz class, using that. So I need all seminorms to have a limit of the following thing, g of epsilon x times f of x equals f of x. That's limit, a lemma. That's a result of a technical lemma. Technical lemma statement 2 is, let's take h even just in L1. With, I'll take the integral of h equal to 1. Of h, not an absolute value of h. And they'll do the following thing. Suppose that f of x is bounded and continuous. Bounded and continuous at 0. Then I do the following thing. I'm going to integrate f of x integrated against 1 upon epsilon to the n h of x over epsilon dx. And I'm going to take a limit as epsilon goes to 0, and that's equal to f of 0. So in some sense, they're sort of opposites. This scales out, so every point looks like g at 0, and this scales in. The support of this version of h gets more and more crowded near the origin. Okay? And let's see, I just want to make a note, which is this operation, the operation in 2, the limit in my statement 2 is an approximation theorem for the delta function. That's what it is. Is a method of approximating of the delta function. The delta function at 0. H is, could be smooth, could be not smooth. Yes, sorry? That's my claim. F is bounded, but could vary all over the place and not be continuous anywhere else, but continuous at 0. Is that possible, to have a function which is discontinuous at every point, but continuous at 0? The answer is yeah. You can do such a thing. No, because h is going to be the integrable part. H provides the integrable character of this. F is bounded. So, where are we on the problem set problems? Problem set number 6. And this is problem 3. Is prove part 1. And just so you don't have to do all the work, I'll prove part 2 for you. Now, if this was Henry McCain talking, he would make you prove it all. So, you're in luck. Who's read Henry McCain's books? A lot is left to you. A lot of the hard work is left to the reader. So let's prove part two. So now let's prove of part two. So let's see. Integral of 1 upon epsilon to the n, g of x upon epsilon dx. I mean to say h. My notes say g, but I mean to say h. Is equal to, let me change variables, I'll say x, epsilon x prime is equal to x, so that I change variables, this is equal to h of x prime dx prime. This gives me x prime. This gives me dx prime, and that's equal to 1. And now, let's see, I need some more room. So let's see. Given a positive delta, we think of delta as getting very small, choose a positive r, think of r being very small, such that f of x minus f at 0 is smaller than delta for x minus x, for x smaller than r. That's continuity of f. And now just I want you to write, we're trying to study this quantity, so let's write that quantity down. So write integral of f of x 1 upon epsilon to the n, keep on writing g when it's supposed to be h, h of x over epsilon dx, it's equal to, well, I can always put this in as f0, as long as I compensate somewhere else, f of x minus f0. The first term is easy, because f of 0 is a constant when you do the integral, so that's clearly f0. I have to worry about the rest. Okay, so I want to split the second into two parts, plus integral, x less than or equal to r, f of x minus f of 0, 1 upon epsilon to the n, h of x over epsilon dx, plus integral x greater than r, f of x, less than r, greater than or equal to r, f of x minus f of 0, 1 upon epsilon n, h of x over epsilon dx. And I guess I'm supposed to call this the answer that I want, f0 plus the first integral I have to bound plus the second integral I have to bound. So let's look at the first integral I have to bound. Let's look at its absolute value. So that's the absolute value of all the x's smaller than r, f of x minus f of 0, 1 upon epsilon n, h of x over epsilon dx, close the absolute value. And of course, let's see, what should we do with this? The thing we have going is that f of x is near f of 0 when you're in that small neighborhood. So this is bounded by delta. You agree with me? And this is bounded by 1. Because I only increase that number by crossing out that limit and saying x over all of Rn. And that number is 1. So the first thing is less than delta. How about I2? That's equal to all the x's greater than or equal to r, f of x minus f of 0, 1 upon epsilon n, h of x over epsilon dx, absolute value. That's true. That is true. That is true. That is true. So that's true. So you don't just put the absolute value inside and then integrate.
Well, we have to show that absolute value is actually equal to 1.
No, but actually it doesn't matter. I could do a slightly more elaborate procedure, or I could put this, you know what you want me to do? HL1. Ha! Thanks. Thanks very much. I stand chastised, but actually I think you could do it even without that, but let's do it with that. Oh, H and L1 means its absolute value is integrable. Doesn't matter. There could be compensation. And just precisely for that compensation that I say this could be 2 and not 1, that's why Lars wanted me to put a number there, which I think is a good idea. L1 norm of H, but we're getting more elaborate. The people who's seeing this lemma for the first time have this conversation at this level, and I'd rather have a conversation at this level. So let's talk at lunch. Debate where we should put the L1 norm of H. Otherwise, I'll change things. You know, whatever. It's correct. It was correct. It's correct now, and we can go on. 2, what about how are we going to get the size of this? Well, it seems to me this is less than or equal to twice the sup over all x of f. Because here's 1 and here's possibly 2 times the absolute value of the x greater than or equal to r, 1 upon epsilon n, h of x over epsilon dx. Which I can also write as twice sup over x of f of x times the integral over, let's see what it was, x prime, x is equal to epsilon x prime. So x greater than r means x prime greater than r upon epsilon. So this is x prime greater than r upon epsilon. H of x prime, 1 upon epsilon n dx is dx prime. We've already done this before. And now, if I take epsilon large, this is a large ball. But H is an L1, so its integrals over large balls have to go to 0. So we can also, by taking epsilon small, make this small. By originally taking delta small, we can make this small. Now we can make epsilon small. So we can get this to look like F0 plus small numbers. And that's what I wanted to do. So we're done. I want to use this. Corollary is that the space C0 infinity, which we decided it was in Schwarz class for pretty clear reasons. If it's 0 outside a finite set, certainly, if a function, a smooth function is 0 outside a bounded set, it certainly goes to infinity faster than any zero faster than any polynomial. It's already 0. But what I want to say, this is dense. So this inclusion has this dense in S. And so, proof. Well, I'm going to use lemma, I'm not going to use the part that I proved, I'm going to prove the part that you proved, which is take any g in C naught infinity, which is fits the hypothesis of dilemma 1, as long as g of 0 is equal to 1. And then take f, an arbitrary Schwarz class function, and let's do the following thing, g of epsilon x, f of x. Well, this is, by dilating variables, you don't change the fact that 1, it's smooth, and 2, it's compact support. So this is C naught infinity. But also, the limit as epsilon goes to 0 of g epsilon x, f of x, the limit equals f of x in the Schwarz class sense. This limit in the Schwarz class sense is f of x. So you can get arbitrary close to Schwarz functions by C naught infinity functions. Okay, let's see. Definition 7. The distributions, these famous things which are not functions, but are extremely useful nonetheless, the distributions, so the space of distributions, so the set of distributions, the distributions of form are form, let me see, how do I want to say this? I'm trying to define the distribution, I'm trying to make English, a good English sentence. The distributions consist of the space V, space of bounded, which I should say is continuous linear functionals on, well, C naught infinity, I need some audience help to get this right now, because they all have these names which I forget. And you can do the following thing. So I make a little table. I think that's the distribution. So that means that the distributions prime, the distributions are equal to C naught infinity, the dual space. Now what are we supposed to call these, D prime or E prime? That's what I'm confused over. What's the name of it? This is C0 infinity. So this is D prime, thanks. Then the temperate, so these are the distributions. And now the Schwarz class prime, well that's Schwarz class prime. Are called tempered distributions. Tempered distributions. And so that's, so let's see. So their dual space is here, and of course this is, so this is dual to C naught infinity, and this is dual to the Schwarz class. And then I have C infinity, where I gave no growth restrictions. And that has a dual space too, and that was my notational question. This is then called E prime, I think. Is that right? Have I got my notation right? There's a D and an E, and I always forget which one is which. I think I just want to give you the standard notation. Because if I screw it up, then it's very confusing when it's used other places. Okay, and these are called, I don't know. They're called the dual things. Now, of course, we learned that this is in this is in this. So on dual spaces, it goes the other way. This is in this is in this. Sorry? How do you know that? Facts of functional analysis life. Okay? I'm still trying to get to the Fourier transform. So the statement is the Fourier transform acts nicely on S. And the way to say that in a more precise way, well, in fact, let me just talk for a second about the Fourier transform of something. Let me take f of x. I want to take its Fourier transform, so it's e to the minus I c dot x, and I take integral and I normalize that, 2 pi to the n, and that's, of course, I've called it two things now today. I've called it f hat of c, but it's an operation on f, on that original function f. And now, we were a little hesitant in the first meetings of the course because I was taking L2 functions and taking their Fourier transforms. I'm supposed to talk about the analysis of that today. So what I want to say, if f is in Schwarz class, this is an integral which converges absolutely. Because the problems are, is f bounded? Because the complex exponential is. So on any compact set, this is going to be a bounded integrand. And then I have to worry about what happens at infinity. This doesn't go to zero at infinity, but this does. Fast enough to be integrable. In fact, fast enough for any of its derivatives to be integrable. So among other things, this is a good integrand, and I can multiply through by x's and c's and differentiate with impunity, and it still converges absolutely. That's why Schwarz class is so nice. So with little analytic, just you know, you have to pay very little attention to what you do. It's easy to differentiate under the integral sign. That's the best thing to say. It's a space where you can do what you want in terms of integrations by parts. So what I want to say is theorem definition 7, theorem 8, which is part of this, it acts nicely on S. So that statement is very straightforward, which is the Fourier transform maps S to, even onto itself. That is, whenever S is in Schwarz class, then F hat is in Schwarz class. And that's not quite the onto. That's at least into. So I'll put into. And we'll use the Fourier transform to show that it's actually onto. Okay? And then I don't want to prove that quite yet, but this is the same status as our theorem 3. I want to prove theorem 3, which is about how Fourier transform acts on L2, but I haven't gotten to it yet. I'm still yakking about properties of the function spaces in the Fourier transform. So similarly, I want to talk about, give you a proposition 9, which is properties, so elementary properties of the Fourier transform when acting on functions in Schwarz class. So this is elementary properties. So let's see. Many of these we've had already. I'm just going to codify them. If I take f and I take its x derivatives and I take the Fourier transform and I look at that as a function of c, it's like taking I c f hat of c. And I'm going to pop this up to the following statement. If I have a multi-index, then which gives me a differential operator, then on the Fourier side, I have a multi-index, which gives me multiplication by a monomial. And the I tags along. That's part of it. Statement 2, which is the analog, if I have x times f hat of xi, it's the same thing as taking I d by dxi f hat of xi. And if I take this to the beta, then it's like taking this to the beta. And I want to just note that these are really multi-index operations. So that's two properties. Property three. Oh, in order to do study property three, I just want to define a notation. I've already used it, and it's a little clumsy. I've already used these operations. They're a little clumsy, so I'm going to define them. Yes, you have a question. That's theorem eight. Sorry? I know. So given theorem 8, then we can prove proposition 9, but I deferred the theorem of proposition 8. I'm sorry. Of theorem 8. We're operating under two hypotheses at the moment. That theorem 3 works and theorem 8 works. Okay? It's a little bit what it's called in the theater, suspended disbelief. So I'm just going to put in a little bit of notation, so two operations. I want to do as follows. I want to translate by h f of x, so f of x minus h, that's kind of often called a position boost, and then I want to dilate, so sigma of sub lambda operating on f of x is f of lambda x. So it's dilation. And so then it allows me to say the other things a little bit easier. If I take the position boost of f by h, and I take its Fourier transform, and I look at c, it's f hat at c times e to the minus I h c. H, lambda is a scalar, h is a vector. H is a scalar, H is a vector, lambda is a scalar. I should say that. Lambda in the reals. You could even take a positive, but I don't think you have to. H is an Rn. Four is if I do the following thing, I just multiply e to the I x, e to the I h x, f, and I take its Fourier transform. Now that's a function of c. That's translating on the Fourier transform side. That's a momentum boost. And then five, what happens under dilatations? So sigma lambda of f, and then I take its Fourier transform, and I get the following thing. I get f hat. It's going to be a function of c in the end. But I do the following thing. I dilate in the other direction, 1 upon lambda. But then there's an extra factor, 1 upon lambda to the n. That's just what happens. Okay, so so I guess theorem 8 is not even the Fourier inversion formula on Schwarz class, which is the real deferred thing. So what I want to do, I guess, is prove theorem 8, and it's going to take only a minute. And then move on. So here's proof of theorem 8. And then with regard to the proof of proposition 9, it's real. Once you know that the Fourier transform is Schwarz class 2, it's really just that justifies you doing integrals and passing things under the integral sign. So you just do it. So I want you yourselves to prove proposition 9. Okay? And you needn't even oppress me by passing it in and I have to look at it. Just do it for yourselves. But I highly recommend doing it. Okay? But let's prove proposition 8, which today's proof is almost as easy. So let's take F in Schwarz class, and then at the very least, then at least I can define F hat of C as a absolute convergent integral. So this thing exists. So what we have to do is check that F hat is in fact Schwarz class as well. So what we have to do is we have to check it to have finite seminorms. So I have to check these things. F hat alpha beta seminorm. Well, that's equal to the sup over xi of multiply, it's a function of xi, so you multiply by xi to the alpha, and then you differentiate d by d xi to the beta, f hat of xi, and you take the sup over xi, and you have to find finite numbers for every choice of alpha beta. Oops, I'm embracing the seminorms. Maybe I should leave them up. That's what I need. I need the seminorms finite. So let's just write down what that expression is. So this is equal to the sup over xi, and then absolute value, and then what is the Fourier transform? Well, it's 1 upon root 2 pi to the n integral e to the minus I c dot x f of x dx. But I'm testing not the 0, 0 seminorm, but the alpha beta. So I need to take xi many derivatives with respect to beta of f hat. So the xi, the beta many xi derivatives of f hat are out here, but since this converges well, I can put them inside. And a xi derivative and a xi derivative of the integrand is the powers of minus I x. So I get minus I x powers. And how many powers do I get of them? I get beta many of them. And I still get absolutely convergent integrands. Then after I do that, then I have to multiply that quantity by xi to the alpha. So I multiply by xi to the alpha. But that's xi to the alpha inside. But of course, xi to the alpha e to the minus I xi dot x, I can reread as d by dx to the alpha. Each time I take a d by dx, comes down a minus I xi. So I have to cancel that minus I, so I can take an I. And I put that inside the integrand. I put it right there. Instead of, so I've taken xi, put it inside, and now I'm replacing e to the I xi, minus I xi x by this expression. And then it still decays rapidly, and it's c infinity. So I integrate by parts, all those d xi alphas. So I get 1 upon I to get the sign right, dx to the alpha. That's what it is. And now no matter how many times, now these x's can hit here, but they also can hit here. But no matter what you do, it remains, no matter which operations you perform, just a finite number, of course, but alpha many, beta many, it still remains rapidly decaying, smooth function. So this is finite. Some constant, maybe a new constant. That's all we need. Moreover, so I know it's bad for notes, but I'm going to erase the little gap here and say, moreover, the Fourier transform is continuous on Schwarz class. Moreover, F is continuous on Schwarz class. So what do I have to check? So in order to prove this, I have to do the following thing. I take, suppose Fn converge to F in Schwarz class, which means that you take Fn minus F, and you check it in the alpha beta seminorm, and you need this to go to zero, although you don't say anything about the rate. So what I need to do is then check that the result f hat n minus result f hat in some alpha beta, in all alpha beta seminorms, goes to zero. And so you do the sup over xi. Right, I'm doing this thing, but for this difference. Sup over xi, absolute value 1 upon root 2 pi to the n integral e to the minus I xi dot x. It's just what we were doing. I'm just doing it again. And now, whenever I had a differentiation by beta, I had 1 upon I multiplication by x to the beta. right? Minus ix is 1 upon ix. And every time I had a multiplication by c, I had a 1 upon I d by dx. And those all fall on the difference, fn of x minus f of x. Close the big braces, dx. Close the absolute value. But now I know these things are controlled by these seminorms. The one I just erased. These things are controlled. This quantity is controlled by the Fn minus F seminorms, gamma deltas, and so therefore, this is going to go to zero, and it'll go to zero in a way which makes this absolutely convergent integral also go to zero. So you get these seminorms go. And there's a lot of words, a little bit of writing. It just works, right? It's continuous on Schwarz class. And so, in fact, we're done with this slightly enlarged theorem. So we're done. So we can, with all this in hand, and now we're getting late, we can finally actually talk about the central theorem in Fourier inversion. And I'm going to do that first on Schwarz class. So central theorem, let me write it, theorem, I think we're at theorem 10, aren't we? And this is the basic, what do you call it? The Fourier inversion theorem on S. It says the following thing. Suppose that F is a Schwarz class function. Then, of course, I can take its Fourier transform. Well, then, of course, the Fourier transform of F of C, that's we call F hat of C, is equal to the following integral. I'm just being redundant, so you needn't write this down. E to the minus I C dot X F of X dx. So there's a Fourier transform. We know that's a good thing. So the real statement of the theorem is, then I can recover f of x by doing the following thing, by doing the following inversion formula, 1 upon 2 pi to the n, integral e to the plus I c dot x, f hat of c dx. And I'm going to call, so that's the statement of the theorem. This is a definition of the inverse of the Fourier transform of operating the function f hat, and that's a function of x. Okay? So at least on what the claim is, on Schwarz class, we can invert the Fourier transform. And it also says it's onto, right? Because you want to make sure that you can get every function by the Fourier transform of some other function in Schwarz class. Which function? Fourier transform of the function itself, essentially. Or the inverse Fourier transform of the function itself. And the Fourier transform and its inversion formula are very similar. That's not always the case with integral transforms. They could be very different. I mean, Radon transform, wave packet transforms, the inverse formula looks very, very different. But here, it's almost the same. The only thing is there's a little reflection involved. That I mean, here I have a plus ixc dot x rather than a minus ixc dot x. So it's like a complex conjugation or something. So what can I say? Just have to get the signs right in order to make it right. So let's prove this. And then let's see where we stand. Let's see how many more pages I wanted to talk about. 1, 2, 3, 4. It's a lot of pages, but let's go for a while and then stop when we've run out of patience. So the proof is, well, let's first note it at least works for one function. So if f of x is a Gaussian, e to the minus x squared upon 2, it works. Shall we try? And not only that, I guess I want to put 1 upon root 2 pi to the n. And since that's f, I'm going to call this a special function, capital G. It works for that. So shall we try it? So g of x is that. So what's g hat of c? Turns out to be. Oh, and plug this into that formula, and out comes g hat, which is 1 upon root 2 pi to the n e to the minus c squared upon 2. So, looking at its Fourier transform and just work it out, it looks very similar, and it's even in C and minus C, so you don't even see the plus-minus difference, and you get it back by Fourier inversion formula. So that's nice. It works on one function. That's always pleasant. So, another interpretation. The Fourier transform of G is equal to G. Well, it's equal to G hat of C, but that's G of C, right? Because I just plug in GX and C. So it says it's an eigenfunction of eigenvalue 1 of the Fourier transform. So eigenfunction of F with eigenvalue 1. So, problem set, number 6, and we're already at problem 4. Boy, I'm giving you a lot of work, but they're all easy problems. What are the other well, I'll tell you, the easy question is, what are the other eigenvalues of this operator? And a slightly harder question, what are the other eigenfunctions of this operator? So, what are the other eigenvalues and eigenfunctions of the Fourier transform operator F. Somebody brought this up, I think it was during break, so I had it's nice to do it as a problem set, so you might blame them for bringing it up. In fact, I have it in my notes. It's a nice thing to think about. So let's work on the general. So let's go back to the proof and work on the general case. So actually what I'm going to do is I'm going to recover not generally f of x, but I'm going to recover f of 0. Try to just at least get the value at 0 back from the Fourier inversion formula. Okay? And if we can do the value 0, then I'll screw around and show you we can do any value. But let's at least get f 0 back from knowing the Fourier transform. So I'm going to use lemma. What's the one that you had to prove? Lemma 5, 1. Oh, lemma 5, 2. Not 2, not 1, but 2. So f at 0 is equal to the limit, as epsilon goes to 0, of f of x, 1 upon epsilon to the n. Well, let's see, we have to now choose h accordingly. G has the property that it iterates to 1, and f, being Schwarz class, has the property that it's continuous at 0, bounded and continuous at 0. So 1 upon epsilon to the n, g upon x over epsilon dx. And so I just want to now make a little series of deductions. So it's a limit as epsilon goes to 0, integral of f of x. I'm just change notation. 1 upon epsilon n, sigma 1 upon epsilon operating on g dx. All I did was use our notation for where our properties. Right. had a list of properties and it had that notation. Oh, here it is. Here it is. Here it is. Okay. And so that's equal to the limit as epsilon goes to 0, integral of f of x. Well, this under that has the property, it's the sigma of epsilon of g hat of x dx, right? Because this, well, this is still a function of x, but I can write this as the hat of g. Let me do it this way. G is this g, and then I'll put a hat in, and I undo the hat. Because hat is equal to 1. Okay? And now let's do one more, which is this is equal to the limit as epsilon goes to 0 of the integral of f hat of xi sigma epsilon g of xi dxi. Whoops, that was a jump. So I have to come back to this. But once I have that, apply lemma 5, 1, which is your job. I already did my work, now you have to do your work. And what does that say is that this thing as limit as epsilon goes to 0, this is equal to what does it say? It says as it goes to 0, it's apply lemma 5-1. It says the following thing, that this integrated against this equals 1 upon root 2 pi to the n I'm saying it wrong. I just want to get it right. That's right. 1 upon root pi, 2 pi to the n, integral of f hat of xi dxi, and it says that that's equal to f of 0. So I have to say that again. I have to say that again. Here I have f of 0 is equal to all this line, and the last line, if I take the limit as epsilon goes to 0 of this, part 1 says that this converges to f hat of xi. And so this converges to this. Oh, and I only have one problem, which is g at 0 is not 1, it's 1 upon root 2 pi n, that factor. That's what I wanted to say. Did I make that last mysterious? It shouldn't have been. All I want to say is this limit is equal to this. And it's that limit because I have Schwarz class convergence of the integrand to this integrand. And the only difference between this limit, this statement, and that statement is here I said g at 0 is equal to 1, and the Gaussians I have g at 0 is 1 over root 2 pi n. So I had to put it in explicitly, and I put it up in front. Okay, so at least we recovered, at least the Fourier inversion formula says that if I have, right, so, and also say the following, if I write this as 1 upon root 2 pi to the n integral e to the I xi dot x f hat of xi dxi, but evaluated at x equals 0, this is 1, and that's that. So it says that I recover the Fourier inversion formula f at 0 from that expression. There's still a deadly silence in this place, so I did something sneaky, it seems to be. Who wants me to say it again? Who wants me to continue? Well, I told you about the red cards and the green cards, right? You're supposed to show me red cards.
So my question isn't about the class steps, but it's about the step where you move the hat and you change the to be like the one that you
called. I have to come back to start. I started it saying I have to redo this. I said, coming back to that, but given this, we can draw our conclusion. No. Okay. I'm going to do star, and then I'm going to come back, okay? So, we're doing step star, which is the following. Oh, which is actually, I'll make a little proposition. And it's proposition 8, where are we? I think I'm 11. Am I proposition 11? Who's keeping up on the numbering? To check that last step, so the statement is for F and G in Schwartz class, then integral of F of X, G hat of minus X bar dx equals integral of F hat of xi, G of xi bar dx. I have to check that. Now the G, little g here is an arbitrary Schwartz class function. Up here it's big G or some dilation of big G, so the minus xx escapes us. We don't really see. But that's what I have to prove. I went from F sigma G hat to F hat sigma G. And that's the step. Okay? Here's the proof of this. Well, let's do this integral. Integral of F hat, F of X. Now let's put in what G hat is. 1 upon root 2 pi n. Integral e to the I x, g of c dx, close, because it's g hat of, this is the Fourier transform of g, and then I evaluate it minus x, I get a plus, there's a little subtlety there, and the only thing that's left is put the bar over everything, dx. This is that. Everyone happy? Which is equal to, if I exchange integrations, where F and G are both Schwartz class, so I exchange integrations, I can write this as 1 upon root 2 pi to the n, put that outside, double integral. I have an F of X, I have an e to the I under the bar, so e to the minus I, xi dot x, g of xi, and at last I'll do dx, and I think I'll do dx right here. And not only that, I'm going to be impossibly hard to take notes to, because I'm going to move the last integral over here. And not only that, I'm going to put parentheses around the thing that I want you to focus on. And I usually call that F hat. Oh, G needs a bar. Thanks. So this is equal to the integral of F hat of xi, G of xi, dxi. That's what I needed. So now we're happy with star. Let me finish by doing that last step again. So I have limit. I have to study the limit as epsilon goes to 0 of the integral of F hat of C sigma epsilon of G of C dC. And I claim that is equal to, well, let's look at the integrand. I have a function f. I still have my lemma on the board. I have a function f of x. That's f hat of x there is called f here. Sigma epsilon g of xi is called g of epsilon x here, the dilation of capital G. And it says the limit as I take epsilon to go to 0, but the limit taken as Schwartz class function, in Schwartz class, it means I control all seminorms of that limit, is equal to what? This at 0. So that's, this limit is f hat c. And I take the integral dx. Is that true? There's only one hypothesis in this lemma that I violated. This G is that dilation of capital, is that capital G, the Gaussian. But Gaussian, that Gaussian is not 1 when x is equal to 0. It's 1 upon root 2 pi to the n. So that means that there's a factor here. 1 upon root 2 pi to the n, which I have not put in yet. So it's 1 upon root 2 pi to the n. That's what I claimed. That's this. Which is the Fourier transform, the inverse Fourier transform formula of f hat for x equals 0. So that says that this is equal to f of 0. Okay. The hour is getting late. I want to finish up. All I've done is the inversion formula for you at the origin. So, I mean, it's a big cheat because I haven't done it at any other spot. So we could get any other value of f at the other spot, you might argue. So I have to just have to make sure that we get it everywhere else. So, absolutely. For x equals 0, it's okay. For x non-equals 0, well, I have that tau operator. So let's say that f of x is really tau to the minus x f at the origin. But we know that is equal to 1 upon root 2 pi to the n integral of the Fourier transform of tau to the minus x of f, a function of xi, dxi. But shifts, so 1 upon root 2 pi to the n, remember those elementary properties, what happens for shifts under Fourier transform? It multiplies the functional, so we get an f hat of xi, that's the Fourier transform of f, but the shift causes an extra phase to appear, ixc dot x, dxc. That's the general case by its properties. So, in fact, we're done. All we had to do was show that we covered 0. And then just by shifting our function around, we got everything else. I want to stop here. We're already a little bit over time. So I'm going to actually just race through the dying embers of this course meeting by saying that how do you do the problem in L2? And actually, we're already set up. All we have to do is show that Schwarz class is dense in L2, and that this is a bounded linear operator on L2, which can be extended uniquely to on Schwarz class, which can be extended uniquely to a bounded operator on L2. So it's really, you can wave your hands with abstract nonsense functional analysis and show that Fourier transform is bounded on L2. Secondly, I want to show more than that f is an isometry. But that's now, since we're over time, it's going to be problem set number 6, problem 5. And that is, show me the following. Show that this Fourier transform is unitary on L2. And that means I want you to show the following, that if I have f Fourier transform on G, it's equal to Fourier transform adjoint of f G. That's just the definition of the adjoint. I want this to be Fourier inverse f on G. I think that's what I want to say. Is that what I want to say, to be a unitary operator? I think so. Okay, so show me that, and then we're done. And that's essentially the circle of ideas, which is natural to work on L2. It's natural to work on Schwarz class. The Poincaré theorem holds, and plus derivatives, dilations, translations, multiplications by polynomials all behave well on at least on the Schwarz class of functions. So thanks very much.